with us. John is just going to be taking notes to facilitate our, because I can't take notes worth a damn.
Okay.
But we're going to get on the record here in a second. John, okay. just let me know when you're set up. Bob?
We're ready.
All right, we're going to begin this formal interview. This is Tom Krebs of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's, sorry. Hang on just a second. Let me get this cleared. And let's see. Tom Krebs, Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm joined by my colleagues John Armstrong and Bob Hinckley. It is 10:17 on October 28, 2010. Adam, this interview will be recorded with your consent.
That's fine.
And could I have your consent on the record, please?
You have my, this is Adam Levitin, and you have my consent to record this interview on the record.
Thank you so much. Everyone here will identify themselves as, I'm Tom Krebs from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. It's K-R-E-B-S. And Bob Hinckley, H-I-N-K-L-A-Y.
John Armstrong, A-R-M-S-T-R-O-N-G.
By way of background, Professor Levitin, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the President. It's bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of the major financial institutions, domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of its findings to the President and having it to him by December 15, 2010, which explains a little bit why we're desperately desirous of talking to you. The commission is an agency of the United States government, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 U.S.C. Code Section 1001 concerning false statements.
I know what that section is about.
Very good, sir. All right, let's get a little background here for you. If you would, give us a little bit of your background, please, Professor Levitin.
I am an associate professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. I hold a J.D. From Harvard Law School. I have an MPhil and an AM from Columbia University and an AB from Harvard College. I have, before joining the Georgetown faculty, I worked at Weil, Gotch & Lemanges LLP in New York as a bankruptcy attorney, doing primarily Chapter 11 bankruptcy work. And before that, I was a law clerk to the Honorable Jane Richards Roth on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. At Georgetown, I teach courses in structured finance, bankruptcy, corporate reorganizations, payment systems, secured lending, and contracts.
Could you please describe to us your current position and your current expertise, I mean your expertise in your area?
Actually, before I do, I realize one other thing I should state regarding my background. I have been and am currently a special counsel for the Congressional Oversight Panel that supervises the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Anything I say to you is not in that role and should not be taken as a statement by the Oversight Panel or its staff.
In that connection, presumably you are aware of yesterday's testimony of Catherine Porter.
I am indeed.
Very interesting to us, and which is a good segue into our preferred discussion this morning.
Let me be clear. I was not at the hearing, and I have not read the transcript. But I am acquainted with Catherine Porter, and I have a general sense of what she would be likely to be saying at the hearing. Plus, I've read some news report accounts of it, but I've not seen a transcript, and I was not at the hearing.
Bob Hinckley and I are presently involved in an inquiry into securitization. and its role in connection with the financial crisis. We are aware that securitization firms will contact or will be contacted by the firms, loan originators, desirous of selling pools of loans to them, and then following a period of due diligence, and I use that in very loose terms, there will perhaps be followed an additional round of negotiation with respect to price, and then the securities somehow are supposed to be put over into a trust, and we believe that in most instances is a New York trust. Can you tell us about your knowledge of that procedure?
Yes. So in most cases, residential mortgages are securitized by trusts that purport to be governed by New York law, and as such they would be New York trusts. There are some trusts that are created that I'm aware of that are created as Massachusetts non-business trusts, and some that are Delaware statutory trusts. It's my belief, even though I do not have any firm empirical numbers on this, that the overwhelming majority of residential mortgage securitizations are done through New York trusts, and that Massachusetts non-business trusts and Delaware statutory trusts are by far the exception in residential mortgage securitization. Other types of securitizations, including, let's say, commercial mortgages, use different structures. So that's just something to be aware of. As far as how the process goes, the bare bones process, your bare bones minimum process, and you will often find deals that have where the loan goes through more steps than this, but it's a series of transfers that goes from the originator to the securitization firm, which is either referred to as the sponsor or the seller. And from that sponsor or seller, the loans are transferred to a special purpose subsidiary of the sponsor or seller that's called the depositor. And then from the depositor, the loans are transferred to the trust. The trust pays for the loans by issuing securities. These are primarily debt securities, and because the only assets that the trust will have are mortgages, these securities are called mortgage-backed securities.
If I may interrupt you just for a moment.
Sure.
I am familiar somewhat with a concept called bankruptcy remote. Is under your description, the loan originator transfers the note and mortgages, or supposed to transfer the note and mortgages, to the acquisition arm of the securitization firm. Are there subsequent transfers to LLCs for the purpose of ensuring that the assets, if they get to the trust, are bankruptcy remote?
Yes, that's where the depositor comes in. So let's be clear, the bankruptcy remote has two different meanings. It can mean, one meaning is that in the event that the originator or the sponsor, someone upstream from the trust goes bankrupt, that the assets cannot be clawed back from the trust into the bankruptcy estate. That's one meaning. The second meaning of bankruptcy remote is that the trust itself, or the whatever entity finally ends up holding the mortgages, is itself set up so that it cannot or will not file for bankruptcy. So two different meanings of bankruptcy remoteness. The critical thing in ensuring that the assets are bankruptcy remote from let's say the securitization sponsor or the originator's bankruptcy is to make sure that all the transfers of the loans are what are called true sales, meaning it's actually a sale and not a secured loan. The sale and a secured loan can actually be very difficult to distinguish because economically they can be quite similar. Let me give you an example. Sale and repurchase agreements are economically secured loans, but their form is as a sale and a repurchase. But economically you could view them as a loan that's collateralized by the property that's being sold.
Uh-huh.
So, because it's difficult One of the concerns is because it's economically very difficult to distinguish between the transactions. One of the concern, a critical concern in structuring securitizations, is to try and make sure that you indeed have a true sale. And one, this is done in several ways. One way is to limit whatever, to limit any control or ability that the issuer, I'm sorry, not the issuer, the securitization sponsor has to claw back the assets. And one of the things that's done for that is to create what's called a two-step securitization. That's where you have the insert between the securitization sponsor and the trust. You insert another entity, the special purpose vehicle subsidiary of the sponsor that's called the depositor. This is something that the rating agency started insisting on maybe around 2000 or so. And the idea is that if the securitization sponsor, say Lehman Brothers, were to file for bankruptcy, Lehman Brothers bankruptcy estate could claim, the concern is that Lehman Brothers bankruptcy estate could claim that the securitization transaction was not actually a sale, in which case Lehman would have no claim, the Lehman bankruptcy estate would have no claim to the assets, but was actually a secured loan, and that the Lehman bankruptcy estate could then exercise its equity of redemption, and take back the loans. Obviously having to pay for them, but the payment would be, they would only do this if it worked economically for them, but at a payment that would not be equivalent to the market value of those loans.
Uh-huh.
That's the concern. What's done to prevent that is sticking in an extra entity in between the securitization sponsor and the trust. That's the depositor. Depositor is just an empty shell, does no business other than buys the loans and from the sponsor and simultaneously sells them to the trust. And the reason for this is that if the sponsor goes into bankruptcy, it might be possible to keep the depositor out of bankruptcy. Maybe you even structure it so that the depositor cannot file for bankruptcy. Say if the depositor is a non-business trust, it would not be able to file for bankruptcy. And if you have it set up in that way, the sponsor should not be able to get at the assets in the trust, or at least that's the theory. So that's why you have this additional entity called the depositor involved. Now,
is there typically only one such transfer, or are there more than one?
Typically, there's only one. Typically, it goes from the sponsor, which that might be the acquisition arm of a major financial institution, to the depositor, to the trust.
Okay. Got it. I didn't mean to interrupt you with that issue about bankruptcy remoteness. We were talking about at the time the fact that most of these are New York trusts. How is it that those trusts are established?
I'm not a trust law expert, so let me give you my non-expert understanding.
Surely.
I believe that to establish a New York trust, basically you just need some indenture documents that say we hereby create a trust. And that there may be some minimal statutory requirements under New York's estates, powers, and trust law, but that not much else is required. But this is different than, say, a Delaware statutory trust, where you have to appoint a Delaware statutory trustee. Mind you, a Delaware statutory trustee does nothing except, literally nothing, except collect a fee. It's just a rent collection vehicle for Delaware. But that brings, that's the price of, getting Delaware law to apply. Under New York law, there is no such required statutory trustee. The trustee does not, I believe, does not even need to be a New York entity. But again, I'm not an expert on New York trust law, and I do not, I don't want to go beyond my expertise here.
What are the current marketplace concerns about the creation of these securitization trusts, as you understand them?
As I understand them, the concern is whether the assets, namely the loans, the mortgage loans, were properly transferred to the trusts. Because if the loans were not properly transferred to the trusts, then you have mortgage-backed securities being issued by the trusts that are not, in fact, backed by mortgages. They're just non. They're just securities backed by nothing. And if that's the case, you can imagine there would be an awful lot of ensuing litigation, because all the investors in the mortgage-backed securities thought that they were buying securities backed by mortgages, and now they're finding out at best they're backed by a litigation claim.
Yes.
So here's why there might be a problem transferring the mortgages to the trust. I believe 39 states now. 39 states have adopted both the 2001 revision of Article 9 of the UCC and the 2001 revision of Article 1 of the UCC. That's the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC.
Mm-hmm.
Article 9 deals with two topics. It deals with security interests in personal property and fixtures, not real estate. But it also deals with the sale of various types of debt instruments, including promissory notes. And this is, unfortunately, the way it's drafted, it's not readily apparent that it deals with the second topic, because in Article 9 jargon, a debtor is defined as also including a seller of a promissory note, and a secured party is defined as also being a buyer of a promissory note. And Article 9 is dealing with the sale of promissory notes, but it's only effective to cover that in a state that is also one of the UCC. Now, all 50 states have adopted revised Article 9. Only 39 states have adopted revised Article 1, according to the website of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Law, NCUSL.
Uh-huh.
The reason that Article 1 matters is that the definition of security interest is not in Article 9. It's in Article 1. And in 2001, the 2001 revision of Article 1 expanded the definition of security interest to include the interest of a buyer of a promissory note. Now, you put all that together, and if you have revised Article 9 and revised Article 1, UCC 9203 explains how you would transfer a promissory note, and UCC 9203G adds in that the mortgage follows the note. It says this pretty explicitly in the official reporter's comment to UCC 9203. So in a state that's adopted revised Article 1 and revised Article 9, there is a legal process under Article 9 for transferring a mortgage, for transferring both a note and a mortgage. And it's pretty bare bones. It's basically a very simple contract of sale that you need a value to be given. You need a security agreement, which is just an agreement to do a sale, and it doesn't even have to have a super specific description of the property involved, just has to have an adequate one. And the seller, and this is kind of a key point, the seller has to have rights in the property.
Yeah.
Now, Article 9, now that's the generic legal setting. Let me point out two issues with that. Issue one is that this only deals with transfers between parties of a loan. It does not deal with the enforceability of the loan. If a form of the loan is a negotiable note, it is still governed by Article 3 of the UCC. And this is made explicit in, I believe it's Comment 6 to UCC 9308. So when there's a conflict between Article 3 and 9, Article 9 prevails, but there's no conflict here because Article 9 isn't talking about the enforceability of the note. It's talking about transfers. between a seller and a buyer of the note. Okay, that's kind of your generic legal framework, and I suspect that if you were to speak with, say, the American Securitization Forum or securitization attorneys, they would tell you that's how everything is supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
And as a generic matter, they're right. You have to ask questions about, you know, what happened. What about the states where those 11 states plus, I think, a few territories, including the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, where revisions to UCC Article 1 have not been adopted. But as a general matter, that's how it should work just generically. Here's the problem. UCC is only a set of default rules. And UCC 1, I think it's 302, it's somewhere in Article 1. Article 1 isn't long. I believe it's 1302, permits parties to contract around the UCC. If a private contract provides for something different, it trumps the UCC, except for the handful of spots where the UCC explicitly states you can't contract around this rule.
Mm-hmm.
There's an argument that pooling and servicing agreements, which are the agreement that governs the transfer, pooling and servicing agreement does a few different things. This is an agreement that, number one, serves to create the securitization trust. It's essentially the trust indenture. Number two, it's a contract between a mortgage servicer and the trust to service the mortgages. Number three, it sets out the rights of the mortgage-backed security holders and the terms under which the mortgage-backed securities are going to be issued. And number four, it provides for the sale of the mortgage loans from the sponsor to the depositor, and instantaneously then from the depositor to the trust. So this one document does all these things together. It's possible to split it up into separate documents. Once in a while you see that, but usually it's one document that does everything. It's called a pooling and servicing agreement, or PSA. Now the argument is that a PSA is a form of contracting around the default rules in the Uniform Commercial Code, because pooling and servicing agreements specify a way, or at least the argument is that this is a point that could be debated, but that the argument that is being raised is that pooling and servicing agreements specify a specific way for the notes and the mortgages to be transferred. And it is not the way that is specified, and it's not just the way that's the very easy contract to sale way that Article 9 sets out. Instead, it's a requirement of endorsement of the notes, that they're negotiable instruments and they need to be endorsed, basically under the Article 3 provision of the UCC provisions, that you need a chain of endorsements, and the final endorsement to the trust is to be made in blank. So, you see the big picture before I go on.
The final endorsement of the note or the mortgage or both?
It should be actually, I believe it should actually be both. Even though the arguments that you hear about this tend to focus on the note, not the mortgage.
Okay.
There are questions about how the assignment of the mortgage works involving the mortgage electronic registration or recordation system, MERS. There are questions there. I am not particularly expert in all the MERS issues. If you want to talk to someone about MERS, the person to speak to is Professor Christopher Peterson at the University of Utah School of Law.
All right.
He's been probably the foremost critic of the MERS recordation system. I don't think that my own sense is that there may be issues with MERS, but they are kind of a separate set of issues. They all relate and they're in the same kind of bucket of concerns about proper chain of title, but it's a different issue within that bucket. Okay, so just to see the big picture here, Article 9 is a set of Article 9 is our general provisions, but it's their default rules that can be contracted around. the concern is that pooling, number one, pooling and servicing agreements might consist of just such a contracting round. Number two, they set out a specific method for the transferring of the mortgages. And really, when I say the mortgages, the mortgage loans, really the notes. And then here's where the problem would come in. And the actual transfers did not follow that procedure. That in most cases, I am told, I have not seen this myself. I don't know what's actually in anyone's loan file. But in most cases, I'm told that the notes are either simply endorsed once in blank, that there's not a chain of endorsements, or that they lack endorsements altogether. There are no signatures on some of the notes.
It sounds like the back office couldn't keep up with the front office.
Well, oh no, it sounds like the back office was doing exactly what the front office was doing. If the front office is producing no-doc loans, the back office is saying, we don't need to do documentation either. in some sense, this shouldn't be particularly surprising if there is a problem. Because, I mean, if the underwriting was sloppy on the front end, why would anyone, be punctilious on the back end? It wouldn't be surprising in that sense. Certainly, I want to be clear. This is not a problem about securitization as a general structure. As a general structure, securitization is fine. It works. It's a pretty good thing. This is a problem of application. And, that if there is a problem here, it's simply that, you had a deal structure that specifies here's how you have to do the deal, and parties chose not to follow it. Okay. Now, let me add in what I do know of New York trust law, because this part of the point is important. New York Estates Powers and Trust Law, I believe, is Section 7-2.4.
Uh-huh.
Provides that any transaction by a trust that is in contravention of the trust documents is void. It can't happen.
Gotcha.
This is critical, because if the trust is under New York law and the trust documents say you have to do the transfer this way, and it wasn't done that way, that transfer is in contravention of the trust documents and is void. In other words, it can't happen.
And the impact of that in connection with the securitization process is what?
Is that at this point there are no mortgages. Any mortgage that was not transferred according to the method set out in the pooling and servicing agreement is not actually owned by the securitization trust. It is at that point I presumably still owned by the securitization sponsor.
Well, that's kind of critical given the issues that are currently in vogue with respect to this particular subject. That is, and by the by, have you seen Sheila Bair's proposal where she says give the trust legal protection from lawsuits for a 25% reduction in monthly mortgage payments?
Yes, I was actually in the audience when she mentioned that. It was hard to understand what she was really saying there, because it seemed to be almost, she didn't spell this out in detail. It was almost like a passing thought she said we may need to have some kind of global settlement. And I took it as being just a general proposal of saying, offer the borrowers a significant modification,
mm-hmm.
and if they're able to make that payment, fine, and they get that modification. If they're not able to, if the house is vacant or whatever, then basically say all these transfers are good, everything is kosher here. And if the borrower can't make the reduced payments, let the foreclosure sail on ahead.
So they just turn state law on its head.
It would be federal law jumping in, and assuming that there were not that it was constitutionally permissible, it would be federal law supplanting state law. you'd have to question, you know, how and what way can the federal government do this? Maybe, you know, potentially the Commerce Clause would allow them to do that. Maybe you could even figure out a way to invoke the bankruptcy power. You know, you'd probably have to have someone file for bankruptcy. I don't know who that'd be, the trust maybe. You could name the bankruptcy can grant clear and quiet title. But that, I mean, I thought it was a policy idea. I thought it was actually kind of moving to a sensible point of trying to sort between borrowers. That the ones who can be saved, save them, and the ones who can't be, even with significant assistance, move those foreclosures through fast. You know, that's an economic policy issue, but any economic policy still has to work within the law, and the deal that borrowers signed up for when they took out mortgages was, if I don't pay, the proper mortgagee can come in, foreclose on my house, according to the proper legal procedure.
Sure.
It's due not, process.
And that process is actually an economic part of the deal. And I'll give you, illustrate this for you. Some states have judicial foreclosure proceedings, some states have non-judicial. There's a wonderful study by a Federal Reserve economist named Karen Pence about the mortgage credit availability differentials between states that have judicial foreclosure and states that have non-judicial foreclosure. An unpublished version of the study also shows pricing differentials, but availability is basically just synonymous with pricing, because you change the price, you change availability, and vice versa. What the study finds is that in states with judicial foreclosure, mortgages are essentially more expensive. So that and what that means is that homeowners in judicial foreclosure states are paying more to get for their mortgages, because they're getting better due process protection.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
and that's part of the economic bargain that's being made, and what we've seen with sort of the foreclosure irregularities and robo-signers, that's a real problem. Not just because due process isn't being followed, it's a problem, and it's a fraud on the court. It's a problem because you have essentially a default on the lender's side as to its bargain. Yes, the homeowner is defaulted, but you also have a default by the lender, that the lender's not keeping its end of the bargain.
Gotcha.
And it's hard. It would be hard for the federal government just to go in and overturn that, probably.
I think that would be difficult. If the federal government thinks that this is a kind of a national economic crisis that's brewing here, then I would think that the Commerce Clause, I would hope it would be broad enough to allow federal intervention to stave off a kind of a national economic crisis, but there's at least a question on that.
Well, but they would be standing state law that's been around since colonial times on its head.
That's correct. That's what federal intervention would do here. On the other hand, this is ancient, long-standing law, but I'm not sure that you respect tradition at the expense of the country.
The point being is that it's also likely to screw up title in these jurisdictions for decades.
Well, so this is, yeah, here's actually an important point to say that I think is often missed on this issue. This is not just a problem. If there's been a problem of transfers of loans to the trust, it's not just a problem of default for defaulted mortgages.
Yes.
Yes.
That's a problem for
everyone.
That's right. And then you have to ask, how far back did this problem go? I mean, we've had this, I don't think this is a problem that's restricted to private label securitization. I would assume that this is a problem that also applies to the GSEs, which means at this point, that's, you know, federal government on the line for that. And this could be a problem that goes way back past the housing bubble. Theoretically, it could go back all the way to the beginning of Fannie Mae securitization or something.
Or at least the beginning of MERS.
at least, or at least 2000. That's one another possibility with the MERS issue, or at least the 2001, because before 2001, you had you couldn't transfer the note under Article 9, so you would have to transfer the note according to traditional Article 3 process. And just as a generic matter, not even if regardless of what the pooling and servicing agreement would say. So, but the PSA is basically saying follow Article 3. So most likely this is a problem that dates from as farthest back as most likely 2001, I think. And recognize then that not every state adopted the Article 1 revisions in 2001. So for the states that haven't, maybe it doesn't quite go that far back. But that's an awful lot of mortgages.
Oh, that's at least, for MERS, that's at least 63 million mortgages.
That is registered in that time period. Because there are only 50 million mortgages in the U.S.
Well, according to TARP, last year, MERS had handled or was involved in 63 million mortgages.
I know why. I bet that number is counting. It's probably inflated because you have refinances, so you're counting the original mortgage and the refinanced one.
Probably,
According to the U.S. Census, they have a sub-study within that, like the American Housing Survey Census or something. There are, I think, just upwards of 50 million mortgages, maybe it's 51 million or something. It's probably less now, given the given foreclosures.
All right. Go ahead, Bob.
Could I just recap this thing for a minute, Professor Levitan, to make sure I understand it?
Of course.
The problem deals with the transfer mainly from, when it comes to trust law, the problem mainly deals with the transfer of the note under Article 9.
If Article 9
applies.
Does Article 9 apply? And if it doesn't apply, were the trust documents followed?
Right.
That's correct.
Okay. And Article 9 requires...
Article 9 requires that there be value for a transfer, that there be value given.
Yep.
That the transferor have rights in the property,
right?
Because you can't transfer more, you can't sell more than you have, right?
Right,
that's
exactly.
The Nemo Dot principle. I can't sell you the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yep.
And thirdly, that there be an authenticated security agreement, which means basically some kind of contract of sale that the seller signs.
Okay, so if Article 9 applies...
If Article 9 applies, this should all be fine, I think.
It should all be fine.
But you have to add little asterisks.
Except in 11 states.
Exactly, and depending on when states adopted the Article 1 revisions, it could actually be more states.
Okay.
But yes, that you have at least 11 states, and those include... I have a list of them right here if you want to.
Yes, please.
One second. Let's see. I was just arguing about this last night with a securitization lawyer. Okay, so we've got, these are the states that I think and territories I think that have not adopted.
Yes.
Based on what's on McCusel's website. I can't swear that McCusel's website is completely accurate here. We've got District of Columbia, Georgia, Guam, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, New Jersey, Ohio, Puerto Rico, South Carolina, Washington, and Wyoming.
Okay. And what we're talking about here is really the note. The mortgage doesn't play into it because the mortgage is covered by state law.
Well, okay. So for the 39 states that have and the U.S. Virgin Islands that have adopted the 2001 revisions of Article 9 and Article 1,
right?
Then there's no problem with the mortgage because Article 9, 9203G says a transfer of the note suffices to transfer the mortgage. in those 11 states plus some territories that have not adopted Article 1, then there's a question, you know, and which is just a state law question of how do you transfer a mortgage?
Okay.
And there are, you know, there are some questions there that it's particularly. So there's kind of a general principle that a lot of jurisdictions have that the mortgage follows the note, but it's not. But that's typically not in statute. That's typically a case law principle, and it conflicts with another case law principle in some jurisdictions. Some jurisdictions are what are called title theory jurisdictions. So that title theory is a kind of property law concept that is contrasted with what's called lien theory, and what that means is in a title theory state, a mortgage is actually considered ownership of the underlying property. Think of this like a deed of trust, and deed of trust actually the property is deeded over to the deed of trust trustee, and then when it's paid off, the deed is deeded back. In title theory states, the mortgage is actually considered the actual ownership of the property, not a lien on the property, and it would follow from that if it's actual ownership of the property, you have to transfer the mortgage the same way you would the property. And among other problems that would create is that you can't endorse the mortgage in blank, or at least I don't think you can.
Right.
This is you know, a state law question, but as a general matter, you can't transfer property to no one in the United States. There is no ownerless property.
Right.
And not least because someone needs to be responsible for that property for tax purposes, because otherwise they can say, hey,
yeah, of course.
I don't know about real estate taxes, I transferred it in blank. It's just sitting in my, you know, the deed's sitting in my file cabinet, but it's in blank. So it's not clear that you can transfer mortgages in blank. And this is certainly an issue that's come up in a case that was just argued before the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. A case called Ibanez, Ibanez versus U.S. Bank. And it has a companion case, which is Larace, Larace, capital R, versus, I think it's Wells Fargo. And these are cases that started as Massachusetts is a title theory state, but it's also a non-judicial foreclosure state. So it started with a non-judicial foreclosure, and homeowners challenged the foreclosure on some rather, you know, insignificant procedural grounds. They were arguing that the foreclosure sale was advertised in the wrong newspaper. It was advertised in the Boston Globe, and they live in Springfield, and Boston Globe isn't a paper of record for Springfield. Okay, you know, that's not going to keep it. Kind of a long shot argument. So the homeowners challenged the non-judicial foreclosure in the land court with a quiet title action. The land court judge, on his own, said and looked at the documents and said, "Hey, U.S. Bank, you didn't. I see here that the mortgage wasn't transferred to you. The assignment of the mortgage took place after you brought the foreclosure action. What gives? You can't bring a foreclosure action if the mortgage hasn't been assigned to you." And he asked for argument about this issue. And they duked it out in the land court, and the banks lost in the land court. And so it was taken on. Case went up on direct appeal to the state Supreme Court, the Supreme Judicial Court, and they heard arguments about it last week. Maybe three weeks ago. We'll see what happens. My own read of the brief is that, you know, it's not clear how broad of a ruling the court will give, and they could rule on this on rather narrow grounds. I have trouble believing that the homeowners are going to lose on this one. That the banks, in part, they just the lawyer on this one. Looks like it's on borderline of malpractice. But their argument it's hard to tell if it's the lawyers who screwed up or their clients. But their argument is based on the pooling and servicing agreement. They didn't put the pooling and servicing agreement in the record. Two companion cases. One case they didn't put it in the record. The other case they can't even find it. So they're in one case, at least now they're before the Supreme Court, they're offering to put it in the record now. In the other case, they can't even find the pooling and servicing agreement to offer to put it in the record.
God,
it was a private placement deal, and all they have is a private placement memo. On top of that, the pooling and servicing agreement doesn't identify itself which properties involve. There's a schedule to the pooling and servicing agreement
right.
that does. It's usually Schedule A or Schedule I, you know, Roman numeral I, Roman so Schedule 1. You know.
Right, the first one.
That schedule is typically, you know, typically not publicly available. If you went to like Edgar and looked at, you know, pooling and servicing agreements, usually it'll say, you know, Schedule 1 intentionally omitted or Schedule 1 is on file, with, you know, they'll give a name of a law firm, you know, often like Thatcher, Prophet, and Wood.
Yeah.
Which is a little problem with law firms that don't exist anymore. But they weren't able to produce the original schedule. Instead, they were able to produce something that looks, it's not even quite clear what they got it from, but it doesn't actually list the street address of the property. It just says that the property's in Springfield, Massachusetts. Which, you know, well, what if there's more than one property in Springfield, Massachusetts?
Yeah, right.
You know, so there's a mess there, and it's not clear if the problems are in the bank, where, you know, the bank can't produce the documents, or that the lawyers didn't bother asking their client. My temptation is, I mean, it's a pretty good law firm involved, K&L Gates. I would say, you know, you'd think that they would have. After client said, we need the documents to their client. And when you read through the details of this case, not only the problem I've been talking about, which they aren't litigating this theory of the case in this one about the method of transfer, but there's not only that problem. You see that there are all kinds of problems just on the front end. Things like missing signature, you know, the transfer of the loan from the originator to to the securitization sponsor, you know, maybe it might be missing signatures.
Yep.
Or it has a signature, but it doesn't have a corporate seal on it. So imagine, you know, it's like Jamie Dimon signing away Chase's corporate property. He can do that in his role as Chase CEO if he's duly authorized. He can't do that just in his private persona. This is just, you can look at lots and lots of cases, the foreclosure defense actions, where you see just tons of irregularities in the paperwork. Now, critical point here is that that doesn't mean that the borrower has a right to keep the house, per se.
Yeah.
That, you know, in most foreclosure actions, the borrower's defaulted. Heck, they're probably at this point a year behind on a mortgage or something.
Yeah.
But the issue is who has the right to foreclose.
Yeah.
And only the proven mortgagee has that right. And if there's a problem proving who the mortgagee is, until that's done, basically you have to assume that the loan is in forbearance.
Isn't it, I'll ask you to comment on this, isn't it fair to say that essentially securitization worked well until, and it worked well when 99.5% of the mortgages were paid out and 0.5% defaulted and they went to foreclosure. And now, because of the volumes that are going to foreclosure, it's become apparent that the banks didn't cross their T's and dot their I's, and actually more serious problems than that. And defense lawyers are going to take advantage of that and gum up the process as best they can in the interest of their clients.
That's absolutely correct.
And so we have this system that just doesn't know how to deal with it. And it isn't going to get better anytime soon until somebody offers a solution such as, and I'm assuming Sheila Bair's work, which may be a big assumption. So somebody comes to a rational resolution of this thing.
I think that's right. The securitization deals, you know, they're incredibly complex, you know, long, complex documents, but they're designed, and this is not something specific to securitization. This is just a general matter of kind of contracting. You contract for the problems that you think are going to happen. You don't, and contracts cover those issues pretty well.
Yep.
It's the problems that no one saw coming that contracts don't address well. And when when the securitization deal, kind of when basic templates for pooling and servicing agreements were drafted, no one was anticipating the level of defaults on mortgages that exist today. The deals weren't prepared for that, and you can see that simply in servicer compensation. Servicers make their compensation is complicated, but the biggest piece of their compensation is a servicing fee that ranges from 25 to 50 basis points of the outstanding principal amount. That's not enough to cover the cost of really doing hands-on loss mitigation,
yeah.
Meaning going and modifying loans to maximize present value. And for that matter, servicers are given very, very little direction on what to do with a defaulted loan. They are, if you tell them, the servicer, maximize net present value of the loan, well, how do you do that? What are the assumptions in your net present value formula? Nothing, but depending on the assumptions, that radically changes whether you do a modification or you proceed to foreclosure. These deals just weren't set up on that level. They weren't set up on the mortgage putback side. The putback provisions don't address how you do a putback of a loan that's already been foreclosed on. I mean, I think there's a rational way to do it, but it's not spelled out in the pooling and servicing agreement. The assumption is you find that if there's a defective loan is found and it's put back, and it all happens kind of seamlessly. So these deals were just simply not designed for problems today. And on top of which, typically a homeowner, when they default on a mortgage, most homeowners, when they default, they slink away. They don't fight.
Yeah.
But you're seeing increasing numbers of homeowners fighting foreclosures. And simply law of large numbers says, you increase the number of foreclosures, tenfold or whatever, you're going to increase the number of people fighting them tenfold.
Yeah.
So we've got that problem.
And when people find out you can fight, that emboldens them too.
You got it. There's a learning curve going on here. And they see, people see that their neighbor has managed to stay in the house for 2 or 3 years rent-free. And gosh, I was just talking to a GC at a small default servicer. He said they're dealing with a case with a guy in Florida. The guy's been living there rent-free for 12 years.
Well, it's cheaper to pay a lawyer to create a sink than it is to pay the mortgage.
That's right. And he had another guy in Texas, a truck driver, who managed to take the case all the way up to the Fifth Circuit and Court of Appeals. He said the briefs read like they were written by a truck driver, not like a lawyer. But he managed to do them just well enough.
Yeah.
The guy lost in the Fifth Circuit, but he stretched it out for several years, taking up on appeal.
Yeah.
So going back to the point you made about Sheila Bair. Yes, I think that the only way to really fix this and restore confidence to the whole mortgage system, and this is a point that is critical for ensuring that mortgage-backed security, that there's going to be capital flows coming in, that investors are willing to invest in mortgages and trust in this process. The only way to do this is to have, some kind of global solution, and that needs to come through Congress. That this can't be, ultimately, I don't think this is something that can be done by the state attorneys general,
yeah.
with consent, consent decrees with servicers or something. This is something that needs to be done through Congress. And, now we're just kind of talking the politics of it.
Yeah.
I think this is rather difficult because the administration's concern is just, don't make a credit. Is the administration just doesn't want to have any flare-ups. It's think of it like this. The economy is a patient. In 2008, it was in the emergency room.
Yeah.
Now it's been stabilized, and it's in the intensive care unit. They know, it's clear that it's clear. I think if you push anyone in Treasury hard enough, that they'd say yes. There's still things that need to be fixed. There are lingering structural problems, particularly with our largest financial institutions. that are basically essentially zombie institutions, a lot of unrecognized losses, and you know that they're going to be recognizing over time with retained earnings that might take them a decade or something. It's clear that there are problems, but they don't want to have to go back into the OR because they're too scared that if they go back in the OR, it's going to create more trouble, and that politically it's not convenient to do that, even if it's frankly the long term interest of the country.
Yeah. So I think
that's the problem.
You don't anticipate then that to the extent that the REMIC.
We didn't talk about the REMIC issue.
Yeah, but the IRS code has not been followed, that they're not going to say a damn thing about it.
Here we have a question. If there's a problem with, if the transfers didn't take place as they were supposed to, then you have a serious REMIC problem, because almost all these trusts are REMICs, real estate mortgage investment conduits. They're supposed to be gives them a pass-through tax status. This is about 26 U.S.C. 860 capital A through 860 capital G, no parentheses in either of those citations. So they get pass-through tax status, but to get that status with a REMIC, basically you can't stick any, with a few exceptions, you can't stick any new assets into a REMIC once 90 days have passed since its creation. On top of which, then you have New York trust law coming in again and saying, and so the trust documents are pretty clear, saying whatever you do, don't blow the REMIC status.
Yeah.
Now, that means that even if you wanted to take the tax hit, you can't do that because you'd be blowing the REMIC status. And the New York trust law again says, you know, that transaction in contravention of the trust documents is void. And then you can add on a few additional trust law problems of the transfers are supposed to be taking place at a specific time.
Yeah.
They didn't happen at that time. They're not supposed to involve any defaulted loans. They would certainly involve plenty of defaulted loans. So you'd have a mess there. I don't think just fixing the REMIC, even if the Internal Revenue Service basically adopted as a policy non-enforcement, you still have some New York trust law issues. And then you have to get the question, you know, will the service adopt a kind of a non-enforcement policy, and will it do so in any kind of vocal way? Because if the service puts out any guidance that basically says we're not going to be enforcing REMIC or we're going to be taking a very soft view of this,
yeah,
politically there's going to be some blowback, because the blowback is going to be, wait a sec, we're bailing out a bunch of banks now at the expense of, really ultimately at the expense of pension funds, through the tax code, that's not how this is supposed to be done. My guess, my uneducated guess, is that the Internal Revenue Service will not act on one way or another on this.
Thanks.
without clear direction coming from Treasury. And there's certainly a question as to what will happen there.
The controlling documents with respect to New York Trust are the pooling and servicing agreement, and it's something called the mortgage loan purchase agreement, or is it?
Mortgage purchase and sale agreement.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the names used for it vary. That mortgage purchase and sale agreement is typically not an agreement with the trust. That's typically an agreement between the originator or an aggregator and the securitization sponsor. But the trust is not party to that agreement.
All right.
That being said, and this is important to understand on the putback side, the underwriting guidelines in that provision typically get incorporated by reference in the pooling and servicing agreement.
Well, we know a little bit about the underwriting guidelines. They were, for the most part, non-existent. I mean, in terms of the importance seemingly placed on compliance with them, they didn't. And when Bob and I did all the Clayton stuff, so we kind of know what the hell happened there.
Can I make a point on Clayton?
Yes.
So they're doing even if they actually follow their methods, they're doing a sampling of like 10% of a pool.
Yeah.
But just multiply that out, 10% times 10% times 10%, That means, you know, with a single loan, you have, if you try, there is a 0.1% chance that it gets kicked out of three pools.
Yeah.
Yep.
And what that means is there was never a loan that didn't find a home.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Never a loan that didn't find a home. Right.
Yeah. Our analysis was that the system didn't keep bad loans out. It just delayed a few in terms of how long it took them to get there.
Yeah, the three and out rule we found before.
Yeah, you know, a guy I spoke to, who used to be the at Countrywide, he said, yeah, it was three and out, but... You know, with three and out, plus you get in there. If a handful of loans they couldn't get in there, they'd put them in a fourth.
Yeah, three and out, but not always. Sometimes it's a foul tip.
It's a foul, yeah, that's right.
All right, Professor, what do you think the resolution should be?
Ultimately, I think that the responsible thing to do is to have a solution that gives that sorts between bar that sort of deals with homeowners, deals with the securitization chain of title, and deals with bank balance sheets. And what I think that means is you need some kind of system that in a very efficient way sorts between sorts homeowners into two groups. Those who are able to make payments with a significantly modified loan, probably modify, you know, like cookie cutter modifications, where if you can't handle, you know, a new 30-year fixed rate mortgage at 90% LTV or something, 90% mark to market LTV plus at some, you know, they're basically more or less market interest rate. If you can't handle that, you know, we're going to have a quick foreclosure procedure with very, very limited defenses. So those who can be saved, get saved. Those who can't, aren't. We sort between them. And what that means, if you're going to be doing restructuring loans so that they get a lot of them go down to, you know, maybe it's 100% LTV, maybe it's 95, maybe it's 90, but something like that. That means you're doing principal reductions. And if you're doing principal reductions, that means you are wiping out an awful lot of the second liens that are second lien loans, and that is bad news for the big four banks because they have roughly $400 billion in second lien loans on their books, and they have equity that's roughly $400 billion. So what this means is
that right? Does the big banks have $400 billion of second lien loans on their books?
Mm-hmm. Now they're not all. I mean, a lot of them are performing.
Yeah.
There are a lot of them are performing, but they're performing when the first is defaulted, which is a sign that, you know, it's not strategic default on the first. It's a sign of a homeowner who doesn't have enough money. You can't make a partial payment on a mortgage.
Yeah.
The homeowner says, "I don't have enough money to pay the first, but I have enough money to pay the second, and I have enough money to pay the credit card and the car loan, so I'll pay those. I'm going to pay as many bills as I can." They don't understand that there's no, if you default on the first, there's no reason to ever pay on the second.
Yes, right. We understand the banks are encouraging them to pay on the second.
Oh yeah, and then we have this huge problem of, you know, the banks servicing the first and owning the second, which is just, I mean, it's nothing short of criminal in my mind. And how they were ever allowed to do that is just astounding to me. It's such a conflict. But if you're going to do principal write-downs, both on, you know, on the first and, you know, clearly on the second, you're going to end up with the big four banks will be, you know, severely undercapitalized, and they're going to need to be restructured. And frankly, that's something that that's something that needs to be done in general. If only because, you know, right now, the banks are going around like zombies. That they are essentially insolvent. I mean, they're not illiquid, but they're insolvent. And that is constraining economic growth right now.
Yeah.
Because they aren't lending. They're not lending because they don't really have any money to lend. So the only, you know, we have to ultimately go. It wasn't enough just to the capital injections that we gave them in 2008. That was stabilization. That was liquidity support ultimately. what needs to be done now is they need to be recapitalized, and that probably means, you know, well, we have a shiny new Dodd-Frank resolution procedure for doing that. It's supposed to be liquidation, but, you know, you do, it probably gets done with a bridge bank, and you know, the equity and maybe some of the long, the equity gets wiped out, maybe some of the long bonds do, or they take a hit, and you, you try and start them up again, but it's like rebooting the computer.
Damn.
So that's kind of the, you know, the, it's a radical solution maybe, but it's, I otherwise I think if we, I think our choice is either going down that road and really tackling, taking the problem seriously, or continuing to just have the economy
limp along,
drag along and drag along. And if we see another drop in housing prices, and it sure looks like that's going to happen, that we're going to see another 10 to 15% drop.
Yeah.
If we see that, at that point, you know, over half the country is, I believe, will be underwater on their mortgages. Right now we're around maybe 25%. And if you include, in 25% who are actually underwater, if you include people who are at like 95% who, if you say underwater really has to be 95% to cover the cost of sale, not 100%.
Right.
You know, it's somewhere greater. So we see another housing price decline, and, you know, the majority of mortgagors will be underwater.
If you were a vengeful person, and I don't think that you are, who would you blame? I am that person.
who would I blame? You know,
I work with Javert.
It's not a person. It's rather, this is a little bit of, I actually would love to be able to say yes. So, you know, so Angela Mozzillo did this or something, but no, this is a system problem. This is a problem where we let financial innovation speed ahead and kind of break loose of regulatory moorings. And this, regulation doesn't necessarily solve everything, but I think we're seeing kind of a case of a financial Frankenstein with securitization, where this well intentioned and, you know, formerly well working process it kind of got to get out of control, and it was I think the roots of the problem you can look at being really in starting in 2001. I think so when you talk about the housing bubble, I think we actually have to talk about two different bubbles. That we have, you know, low interest rates in 2001, and we see this enormous boom of refinancings. But those are almost all of those are conventional conforming fixed rate mortgage refinancings. It's not exotic loans at that point. But there's this huge boom in refinancing activity that puts a lot of money moving into the housing finance system. In 2000, starting late 2003, 2004, that boom is kind of, it started to peter off. But you have companies that have these, you know, vastly inflated earnings for a couple of years, now dealing with the prospect of reduced earnings, and they want to keep up their volume. And how do they do that? They have to find more people to get who they can put into mortgages. And how do you do that? You lower your underwriting standards. You change your product mix. You switch things around so that you can try and expand your borrower pool. And that keeps the bubble going a little bit. It raises home ownership rates a little bit. And then, you know, you think that there would be some market limit to risk. And there's a wonderful study by a guy named Manuel Adelino at MIT that he said he looks at whether...
Adelino.
I-N-O. He has a study...
Manuel.
He has a study looking at AAA and BBB RMBS investors. And basically, let's look at the pricing what was the yield they demanded on deals that performed well versus deals that went bust? Were they able to sniff out the riskier deals? The BBB investors, your subordinated debt investors, had some ability to do that. They weren't perfect, but they had a sense of, on riskier deals, they tended to demand a greater return. the AAA investors were clueless. They had no ability to sniff this stuff out. They were buying and the implication is they were buying a rating, right?
Yeah.
Here's your problem. You know, so if that was the world, there would be a risk. There would be a limit of how much risk could come into the system, because the AAA, there'd be a risk. There's a threshold to the AAA investors' risk appetite. The AAA investors were essentially were outbid by CDOs. CDO asset managers didn't care what quality they were getting. They just wanted to put assets under management.
Yeah.
The BBB investors would have said, you know, we need a yield of 10%. CDOs come and say, hey, we'll do it for 6%. And this happens not just in the residential market. This also happens in the commercial market. Commercial market, you see a boom in CDOs in around 2004, and you have a parallel commercial mortgage securities bubble. The commercial mortgage bubble tracks the residential one almost identically. And that has some, I think, rather profound implications, because it points to what the causes of that bubble were. It says, you know, Community Reinvestment Act and affordable housing goals have no relationship whatsoever to commercial. So, you know, even if you think, so you have to...
It was investor-driven, not Freddie Mac-driven.
You got it. And I have a paper, I have a rather lengthy paper about this that I wrote with Susan Wachter at the Wharton School. It's entitled Explaining the Housing Bubble. We gave it, you know, rather grand title.
Yeah.
But we think we can show, just as an empirical matter, that this is a supply-side bubble, not a demand-side.
Can we get that paper?
Sure.
Is it on the web?
On SSRN.
Okay. Great stuff.
The key figure to look at, you want to look at figure 14.
Okay.
It shows the yield spreads on AAA MBS and AAA corporates, and you see that AAA MBS start trading through the AAA corporates. That they're, even as risk is going up dramatically on the AAA MBS, the yields are dropping. So your risk-adjusted yield is dropping like mad.
Yep.
And volume is increasing. Deal volume is increasing. And the only way that you can have prices drop and quantity increase is if your supply curve is shifting to the right, outwards, faster than your demand curve is moving outwards. So that this means that this bubble had to primarily be, and I emphasize primarily, not that we don't claim exclusively, but primarily a supply-side bubble. And then you have to go and look at it, try and figure out, well, what was the supply-side cause? And, you know, okay, Community Reinvestment Act or affordable housing goals, those are supply-side factors, but the timing just doesn't work with them, because they've been around for ages, and Susan and I think that that the real bubble starts quite late. We think it's a 2004 to 2006 bubble. And we have a section of the paper that goes through why we think that if you compare it with rental prices, rental price appreciation. Another possibility is monetary policy, but that makes sense if the bubble started in 2001, but it's really a 2004. If it's a 2004 bubble, the monetary policy story doesn't fit. And Bernanke has a very good speech that kind of takes on the monetary policy view. So we think that you're kind of left with the other change that really happened around 2004, which was the real growth in private label securitization and in the collateralized debt obligation market.
Yep.
You're talking to two adherents here.
I'm sorry?
We are adherents of that belief. I mean, that
you may be adherents of it, but I don't know if all your panelists are. Or if they,
oh,
if
good
they,
God, no.
I unfortunately have the belief that at least some of the panelists, the commission members, came in with views that, you know, had views that they came in with, and evidence be damned.
Well, as happens,
I won't name any names.
Yeah. You know, that happens in a number of cases.
That's not an atypical outcome for this kind of thing. Unfortunately, it's 11:30, and I'm gonna have to get myself a cab to the airport.
Thank you very much.
If you have follow up questions, email my and time is of the essence. Email will be the best way to handle it.
Thank you very much.
Again,
Adam.
Sure, my pleasure.
Have a good trip.
Thanks. Bye bye.
We are off the record at.
That guy was terrific.
11:31.
That guy's terrific. Guess what?